Hello, everybody. This is Georgianne Hughes, and this is The Bite Show. And we're very blessed to have with us David Seeloff. And you can visit the website, AskElm, that's AskElm.com. You can email David Seeloff at this address, David@AskElm.com. And David Seeloff is the Director of Associates for Scriptural Knowledge, and he does carry on the work of Dr. Ernest L. Martin. And we've been working on a series called The Tithing Dilemma. This is also an online book, and you can find that at AskElm.com. We are beginning Part 3 and Chapter 8 in the book. Hi, David.
Hi, Georgianne. Yeah, we're moving along. There's quite a bit of a delay, but we're continuing on this, and we should finish up in the next couple of shows. And, you know, everyone will have an excellent and complete idea exactly what's involved in tithing. So
now, we're looking at tithing as something different than sowing and reaping, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
It is not sowing and reaping. It may have had a relationship to that back in the days of Israel, but it had to have been, tithing had to have been presented to those who were qualified to receive it. And there's no one qualified to receive it today. And because the tithes had to be presented to those individuals who were qualified to receive it at the place where God commanded that they receive it, which was in Jerusalem during New Testament times, and at the temple and at the tabernacle during Old Testament times. So those conditions do not exist at the present time. Therefore, no one is qualified to receive tithes at this present time. And most people also misunderstand what goods and services were tithable.
Yeah.
Actually, no services were tithable. That's all free will offerings, if you will. But only agricultural goods and, you know, from the farms and the flocks were tithable. And those could be converted into money. But money was not the preferred method of tithing. That was a convenience for the people. And the purpose of the tithe was to support the priests and the Levites. And that's all. Now, the priests did provide a teaching function, as well as serve in the tabernacle and the temple. And the priests did the hard grunt work of the sacrifices and the cleaning and the maintenance of, and everything else. The families that were related to the priests, they received a tithe of the tithe that the Levites received. The Levites received a tithe from the other tribes, as we covered in previous presentations. And then the Levites, in turn, what they received as individuals, they tithed to the priests, to the priestly families. And those priestly families, I don't believe they tithed. I'd have to check on that in detail and see what the Mishnah has to say, but on that in the Talmud. But in any case, we're here in Chapter 8 of Dr. Martin's book, The Tithing Dilemma. And the title of this chapter is The Levite's Place in Society. And I'm reading from the book and reading from Chapter 8, and Dr. Martin goes on. What Moses gave to Israel in regard to the tithe was reasonable and very beneficial to the whole nation. Now let's look at the sensibleness of the Mosaic law of tithing. When it is fully understood, it will be seen that it was intended to benefit the whole society within Israel. The Levites were central to it all. Though the tribe of Levi in ancient Israel was empowered to receive tithe of the people, accept that part of the tithe needed by the people for festival requirements and that for the destitute. The Levites also had other ways of earning money, and not all of them were supported by the tithe. The Levites were not given any territorial lands like other Israelites. In other words, they were not supposed to be farmers. They could if they wanted to be, but they weren't. It wasn't foreseen that they would be farmers. They, the Levites, along with the priests, were allotted 48 cities in which they could earn a living. This means that the Levites received a reasonable amount of acreage to cultivate, besides the fact that many of those cities were located in some of the best parts of the land of Canaan. Now, they didn't have to cultivate it, but they could hire people to cultivate it for them. Now, in Numbers chapter 35, verses 1 to 3, it says this, quote, "And the Lord spoke unto Moses in the plains of Moab by the Jordan at Jericho," in other words, before they came in, crossed the Jordan River into the land, "saying," quote, "Command the children of Israel that they give into the Levites, unto the Levites, of their inheritance of their possession cities to dwell in, and open land around the cities shall ye give unto the Levites, and the cities shall they have to dwell in, and their open land shall be for their cattle, and for their substance, and for all their beasts," end quote. Now, many people have not realized that Moses gave the Levites the means by which to earn a living without having a dependence upon the tithe alone. Other than the tithe of the third and sixth years of the sabbatical cycle, the only Levites that received any tithe at all were those who attended the service of the tabernacle. And even then, the tithe was only that part left over from the festival use by ordinary Israelites. At other times, the Levites had to earn their own living within the cities and lands allotted to them. The Levites were expected to work for their livelihood like any other normal citizen within the community of Israel. This is why the Levites were provided with open lands surrounding their cities. The suburb of each Levite city had 1,000 cubits, which is about 1,600 feet, on each side of the city for grazing their cattle. And this is in Numbers chapter 35, verse 4. There was a further 2,000 cubits beyond the first measure surrounding each city that they were to use as fields and vineyards. This is in verse 5 of chapter Numbers 35. The two zones together represented 3,000 cubits of open land extending outward from each side of the city walls. And this is in Lang's Commentary, Volume 2, page 186. At least 4 square miles of land belonging to each Levitical city, at least 4 square miles of land belonged to each Levitical city. Now, with 48 cities being represented, the cumulative amount of land equaled almost 200 square miles for pasturing and cultivation. And it is interesting that this amount of Levitical land was very near the square mileage assigned to the tribes of Benjamin and Zebulun. Since some of the cities that the Levites inherited were the most prosperous in the nation, their combined property value would almost equal that of the lesser Israelite tribes. These facts ought to put to rest the belief of some church leaders who imagined that the Levites lived solely off the tithe of the other tribes. In no way was this true. The Levites had to work for their living as anyone else. Only when Levites attended the service of the tabernacle, whether on a full or part-time basis, was the tithe expected to support them. This is according to Deuteronomy chapter 18, verses 6 to 8. Moreover, God was quite concerned that the Levitical lands remain within the tribe of Levi perpetually. Quote, "But the fields of the open land about their cities may not be sold, for that is their perpetual possession." End quote, Leviticus chapter 25, verse 34. Though the Levites were scattered throughout the land of Israel, there was only one place in the land where they could assist in the service of the tabernacle and later the temple. When Israel came into possession of the land of Canaan, they set up the tabernacle first at Shiloh, and later in the time of Solomon, the tabernacle was finally moved to Jerusalem, where the portable structure was abandoned for the permanent temple. But the greatest percent of the Levites never performed services in the temple. That building was simply too small for them to work there, for all of them to work there. My wife and I attended a little presentation that was presented. I believe the organization was a Seventh-day Adventist organization that had a traveling show, and they had a life-size tabernacle that they would set up in a parking lot, say, of some Seventh-day Adventist church, and we had the opportunity to see it in Southern California a couple times over, once in 1980s and another time, and I think it was 2003, different groups each time. But it was interesting because the tabernacle, both the inner sanctuary and the holy place and the Holy of Holies, together were the size of a small garage. It's very tiny. It's amazing. And this was the portable sanctuary, and Solomon's wasn't much bigger. The inner sanctuary. Now, of course, there were courtyards around it. But even there, it's smaller than, you know, a football field combined. I would say almost about three-quarters, perhaps half, the size of a football field, an American football field. So it's amazing how tiny the things were. And, you know, it was a lot of work to do the sacrifices, and particularly on the feast days. But they called in the people that they knew, and most of the Levites were part-timers. That's the point that Dr. Martin is making, because the facilities were simply not that large. The building was simply too small for all of them to work there. Most Levites performed duties in the other employments within the nation of Israel. The occupation of the Levites were what we would call today the professional fields. Moses expected this to be the case. They were ordained to be the teachers of the nation. And this is in Deuteronomy 24:8, 33:10, 2 Chronicles 35:3, and Nehemiah 8:7. They also represented many of the judges of the land. And in the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, they were the sole members of the Sanhedrin. They were all Levites. The Sanhedrin was the supreme court of the nation. And this is also in Deuteronomy chapter 17, Chronicles chapter 23, 2 Chronicles 19, Ezekiel 13, chapter 14, and Luke 17. You know, I'm not even going to cite the verses. You can just look those up. They were the professional singers and the musicians in both the tabernacle and the temple. They were the producers of books and librarians. In other words, they were the word processors and the typesetters and the printers, because in those days, of course, everything was handwritten. They were the producers of books and librarians, were almost exclusively Levites, according to 2 Chronicles 34, verse 13. It may appear strange to some, but even law enforcement was in their care, according to 1 Chronicles 23 and verse 4. And they were the sheriffs, according to the Moffat translation. Many of the Levites were architects and builders. This is noted in 2 Chronicles 34, verses 8 to 13. As stated before, the Levites earned their living by becoming what we call the professional people of the community. And while the ordinary Israelite gave his tithe every year to the Levites and to the destitute, look at the services that were received besides the management of the temple. Israelite got teachers for their children, physicians for their ills, scribes, musicians, singers, judges, and law enforcement officers. A part of their tithe even went to support a type of Social Security program every third and sixth year for the destitute. Now, people contributed during the third and sixth year, and then it was distributed during the other years. This indicates that the single one tithe, which was distributed differently over a seven-year period, was not intended simply for religious purposes. It was something similar to our taxes that support our educational institutions, our government hospitals, our law enforcement agencies, our social, our cultural societies, etc.
Well, you know, David, the Levites didn't go out and buy gold-plated chariots either.
No.
Right.
But, you know, even that, I mean, when Jesus threw out the money changers, the money changers were there with the permission of the, you know, the Levites and the priests, mm-hmm. as well as the administration of the, you know, so, you know, everybody goes bad. That's what's been occurring to me in, now let me finish the chapter. But,
I'm sorry.
When one sees the true picture of Israel's tithing system, the early Israelites did not get too bad a deal in their payment of tithe. Today, however, the tithe payer normally gets no material benefits at all. He receives the sole opportunity of supporting his church, and that's all he gets. What a far cry from the ancient tithing system of Israel, in which all benefited. You know, the system that God set up is quite a bit different than the system that we have today. But, you know, the tithing system can't function in a massive society. So I don't claim to have any, you know, magic solution to, you certainly can't go back to the tithing system. You know, it was suited for the people of the time. And it'll be interesting to see what kind of system Christ sets up, you know, during the kingdom structure for public administration and all this stuff. And the details, I mean, the details are very important, you know, getting water and into the population and getting sanitation out away from the population and refuse and all the little details that we take for granted in our Western world, you know, are a matter of life and death in the third world. It's quite amazing. The more I study and read and learn, I'm coming to the conclusion that the entire plan of God is set up to demonstrate to all mankind throughout history that every form of government and system that of man's self-government cannot and will not work. Look at the situation before the flood. You have people living long lives so that, you know, people could have said in the flood, well, if we wouldn't have lived so long, we wouldn't have been prone to such evil. So God shortened the length of everybody's life.
Good point.
And look at all the nations of the world. Every single nation has been on top, if not of the world, then of their little local area, above the other nations, and sometimes they were oppressive, and sometimes they were genocidal against neighboring peoples. But everybody has had their opportunity to be on top and to be on the bottom. You know, so don't feel bad if your society was on the bottom, because at one time throughout history, post-flood, your nation was one of the tops, and they had their time in the sun and their time to oppress and, you know, do whatever they want it to other peoples. And, you know, now it's the time of the United States. the United States perhaps will decline and other nations will rise. I don't think there'll be a collapse of the United States. This is not so much an empire as just simple economics of the Babylonian system.
Yes.
And we can disagree and argue on the details, but that's my view of things. And, money is important. It took money to run for the Levites to operate and do what they had to do to have a continuity for the situation of the running of the temple. It was very hard work, killing those animals, cutting them up, cooking the meat, getting rid of the entrails, flushing the bad stuff, the blood, because all the blood had to be drained, and that doesn't happen immediately if you've ever killed an animal and had to dress it out and everything. I have not had that opportunity or responsibility, but I've seen it done. And it's very, very hard work. And that's when you're successful, after you've, killed the deer or the animal. And most of the world has lived on a subsistence situation.
Yeah.
You know, hunter-gatherers.
Yeah.
And then they were able to have flocks so that, they didn't have to go out and chase down food. The food was there among them. And then they grew crops, and they were able to literally grow their clothes as well as their food. And
right.
This is hard stuff. We actually have it pretty easy, but we still require money, to operate, to teach. You require funds for the bite show to operate, and it's not going to continue unless, money comes forth from people to contribute. Same with ASK, but, there's an immediate need for the bite show to succeed and continue and hopefully someday to grow a little more as word gets out.
Yes.
So, it doesn't, a little from everybody would help a lot to continue the bite show. And our little group of supporters at ASK sustains us. We're not a big organization at all.
Yeah.
And yet it's sufficient, and God provides. And God will provide for the bite show and for ASK, or we'll shut down. And that'll be God's decision, but, help us help others. Help us get the word out. And, you might not like what I say, but then listen to somebody else on the bite show who you might like.
Yeah.
That's the way it goes. So that's how it was with the Levites in biblical times, in chapter 8, the Levites' place in society. And for chapter 9 is titled Stealing from God. And it's interesting because many people misapply the particular verse in Malachi 3:7. And Dr. Martin, we're going into chapter 9 now, he says in the titled Stealing from God, probably no section of Scripture has been more often cited in support of an alleged universal law of tithing than Malachi chapter 3, verses 8 to 10. It is a favorite text for ministers today, but in using this section of Scripture as a means to support their modern and anti-biblical law of tithing, most preachers apply the passage completely and entirely out of context. So what does Malachi say? In Malachi 3, verse 7, quote, from the days of your fathers, you have turned aside from mine ordinances and have not kept them. Return unto me, and I will return unto you, says the Lord of hosts, end quote. Well, who were the people that Malachi said had turned aside from God's ordinances? Were they the Egyptians or the Russians or the Chinese or the British or the Americans? Continue on in verse 7. But you say, wherein shall we return? End quote. Well, who is the ye, or you, to whom Malachi is referring? The answer is plain. It was the ancient Jewish nation existing in the time of Malachi. Verse 8 says, quote, "Will a man rob God? Yet you have robbed me. But you say, wherein have we robbed you? Well, in tithes and offerings," unquote. Well, but who were these robbers? They were the people of Judah who lived in Palestine that Malachi was scolding. They had not been giving their tithe nor their proper animal sacrifices for the rituals of the temple. They were, as Malachi says, cursed with a curse, for you have robbed me, even this whole nation, end quote, in verse 9 of Malachi chapter 3. Yet some have expressed an absurdity that this indictment of Malachi is against the modern United States. What nonsense. Is the United States currently under a curse for not tithing? If we're under a curse, the rest of the world would love to be under this curse.
Oh, yeah.
That's why they're all coming here.
Yeah.
From all over the world. It's quite amazing sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Tithing was not ordained for Americans in the first place. America is not Israel. And a lot of people don't like to hear that, but that's the case. We are not the ten tribes,
yeah.
or one of the ten tribes. If America was cursed, you know, thousands of people from other areas of the world try desperately to come to the United States each year. Do the peoples of India, Africa, and Latin America feel that America is under some type of curse? Is not the United States of America still one of the richest and most bountifully blessed nations that ever existed in the history of mankind? True, there are problems in our country, but which people of the world would say we have been or are under a curse? I know of none. I know of, as a segue for a moment, I know religious organizations that for 25 years have taught that we are under a curse.
Well, the radical Muslims call us the great Satan.
Yet, you know, God appears to be blessing the great Satan.
Yeah.
And, you know, he gave them all that oil, but what are they doing with it, you know?
Right.
I was thinking about the great museums of the world, you know, that mm-hmm. Some countries like Egypt and others have, you know, well, we want our national treasures back because the Germans and the French and the British, they've all stolen our artifacts and taken them off to their museums. Well, they didn't do anything with them. At least they're preserved. Those artifacts are preserved. You know, and money was paid in many cases to the local rulers for permission to take these artifacts out of the country.
That's right.
And now they want them back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, well, what will happen if some of these artifacts come back to Egypt? Egypt is unique, but, you know, if you think about it, why would they want these pagan gods of Egypt to come back to Egypt, which is a Muslim country, which perhaps under a radical Islamic system might deface and further destroy, you know, the heritage of Egypt.
Or use the idols in some kind of rites, you know.
Yeah. I mean, look what they did in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
There was a Buddhist shrine and they destroyed it. That's fine. I have no... Well, it's not fine. It's terrible in terms of artwork.
Yeah.
You know, art should be preserved, just like the Dome of the Rock should be preserved. It's a beautiful piece of architectural work. And the finish and the artistic design on the inside as well as the outside is just really fascinating to look at. I hope to get over there soon and get up there and look at it in detail again. So the United States is not Israel. The United States or the British Commonwealth or Great Britain that are it's not being discussed by Malachi. Malachi is scolding Judah for their failure, and the Levites, for their failure to pay the tithe correctly. And their lapse is not bringing, and their lapse in not bringing proper animal sacrifices for the ritual service of the temple in Jerusalem. It was solely and exclusively to the nation of Judah in the 4th century BCE, and that is what the Bible says. Some people have misapplied these scriptures to support their own opinions about tithing that have no biblical warrant.
You're right.
Malachi continues on with his narrative in verse 10 of chapter 3. Bring you the whole tithe into the storehouses, that there may be meat in mine house, and try me now herewith, says the Lord of hosts, if I will not open you the windows of heaven and pour you out a blessing, that there shall be more than sufficiency. The tithe being discussed by Malachi is clearly the agricultural and animal tithe of ancient Judah. The prophet is actually speaking about food, not money. Food to pay the Levites and the priests. Now, where were the storehouses located of which Malachi was talking? Well, they had their origin back in the time of King Hezekiah, back in the time of this 8th century BCE. This is in 2 Chronicles chapter 31, verses 4 to 10. An order had been given by Hezekiah, King Hezekiah, to bring the tithe of the agricultural produce into the sanctuary. And the people brought such abundance that the Levites had to lay it up in heaps. And this is in verses 5 and 6. Hezekiah then had chambers made in the temple to hold the surplus. And this is in verse 10. They held grain, not money. Now Malachi was interested, in these storehouses. They wanted the storehouses within the temple to be refilled. He, Malachi, wanted the storehouses to be refilled. By the way, a single complex of storage silos in Kansas would be 5 or even 10 times the size of the silos in the temple in Malachi's time. It wasn't a great abundance that Malachi was asking for. He simply wanted the normal agricultural produce to be tithed and to be put in the temple in order to fill the temple storehouses. Besides, all the tithe and offerings that were required by law, according to Deuteronomy 12:6, were supposed to be sent only to the temple in Jerusalem, except in the 3rd and 6th years of a sabbatical cycle. Malachi simply wanted the silos inside the temple to be refilled. A parallel account of Malachi's situation is found in the 13th chapter of the book of Nehemiah. Now, Nehemiah was a contemporary of Malachi. This is beginning in Nehemiah chapter 13, verses 10 to 12. Quote, "And I perceived that the portions of the Levites had not been given them, so that the Levites and the singers, that they did their work, were fled every one to his field. Then I contended I with the rulers of Judah, and said, why is the house of God forsaken? And I gathered them together and set them in their place. Then brought all Judah the tithe of the corn, the grain, and the new wine and the oil unto the treasuries." End quote. So in the days of Nehemiah and Malachi, there were food shortages and much poverty in Judah. This is found in Nehemiah chapter 5, verses 2 to 6. It was in relieving that bad environment that the prophet Malachi promised the Jewish people a help from God. But the country was in bad shape. Insects had devoured much of the land. The animals were not producing properly. They couldn't get sufficient feed. Judah was then, at that moment, under a curse. But Malachi promised the Jews in Palestine a relief. If they would turn from their evil ways, they would have, quote, more than sufficiency. Malachi 3:10. Malachi 3:11 says, quote, "And I will rebuke the devourer," meaning the rapacious insect, "for your good. And he shall not destroy the fruits of your land, neither shall your vine cast its fruit before the time in the field, says the Lord of hosts." These verses of Malachi about ancient Judah in Palestine have nothing to do with modern America, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Britain, or any other nation. Malachi was only interested in the Jews of Palestine filling the silos in the temple back at that time. The tithe probably represented, in our money values today, no more than a few thousand dollars of grain total. After all, the temple was very small, less than an acre in area, and if all the storehouses were filled with grain, it would have hardly equaled a fifth or a tenth of the produce found in one storage complex in Kansas today. Now, tithing was only for the land of Israel. Another factor that's often overlooked, considering the biblical tithing system, is the fact that it only applied to Israelites who lived in Palestine. Leviticus 27, verse 30, it says, quote, "All the tithe of the land, whether of the seed of the land or of the fruit of the tree, is the Lord's, and it is holy unto the Lord," end quote. Notice the major point about this tithing instruction. It said, all, quote, "All the tithe of the land is the Lord's." Now, the Hebrew word rendered land is the common word eretz. At times, the word can mean earth. At other times, it is used in regard to a specific land or country, such as in Exodus 3, verses 8 and 17. Many times, the term is used in Leviticus 27, verse 30. It refers specifically to the land of Israel and Palestine. This is in Leviticus chapter 19, chapter 20, 25, and 26, and so forth. As the Gentile nations were not given tithing laws by God, and Levites were not instructed to go to the Gentiles and take tithes from them, the term "the land" in Leviticus 27:30 really refers to the land of Israel and to the land of Israel alone. George Foot Moore, in his work on Judaism, and he's one of the recognized authorities on Jewish religion in the time of Christ, had the following to say about the law of the tithe in Leviticus chapter 27. Quote, "All of these apply in the letter of the law only to the land of Israel. However, at any time its boundaries might be defined," end quote. This is to be found in Professor Moore's book, Judaism in the First Centuries of the Christian Era, Volume 2, page 71. Now, Professor Moore went on to point out that the land of Babylon was finally accepted as part of the land of Israel. I don't think the Iraqis would like that today. But it was considered a tithable land, according to the Jewish scholars, because so many Jews were resident in the area at the time. Egypt was finally accepted as a tithable land. In the early time of Joseph, however, Egypt did not pay tithe, as shown by the 1/5 produce, which was paid to Pharaoh, and the 4/5 that went to the people. The lands east of the Jordan River came to be acknowledged as tithable. These were the lands of Ammon and Moab and Syria, at least parts of those lands that David conquered and where many Jews came to live. Other Gentile lands, on the other hand, such as Asia Minor, or which is Turkey today, Greece or Italy, were not allowed as lands which could produce a tithe. The produce of these lands was considered as being literally impure and not holy enough to support the Levitical priesthood and its function at the Holy Temple. As Edersheim records, even the dust of heathen lands was reckoned as defiled. And this is in Edersheim's Life and Times of Jesus the Messiah, Volume 1, page 9. Now, this is why tithes were not acceptable from those portions of the world's land. At any rate, the strict reading of the law demanded that the tithe come only from the land of Israel, which was later interpreted to include those areas east and north of Palestine and Egypt, where the populations were predominantly Jewish. All other areas were proscribed and prohibited from contributing tithe. This fact about tithing might be surprising to many Christians, but this is an actual fact that is revealed in the law of God. Many preachers and evangelists know these facts, but they fail to tell the laity about them simply because they believe the people would not fund their churches if they were privy to these facts. So it's time for all people to know the truth of the biblical revelation. To be guided strictly by the statements of biblical law, it would be improper to tithe on products from the United States, Britain, and other Gentile lands. And this does not end the story. There is yet another surprise that most Christians fail to understand. In fact, the temple in Jerusalem did not get the bulk of its income for its operation from the tithe that the Israelites gave on their farm produce and herds. There was another law that Moses enacted that provided huge quantities of money to temple operations when the people were faithful in carrying out the law of the Old Covenant. Moses also legislated that the temple itself was to be, in a primary sense, funded from the giving of a half shekel by every male in Israel. And this is to be found in Exodus chapter 30, verses 11 to 16. This half shekel was to be given each year, and it was to be sent to the temple treasury no matter where Israelites lived in the world. That brought a lot of money. Consider in the Roman Empire, you had a lot of Jews in Rome, in Alexandria, and in Babylon. And a lot of that money was to be intended for the temple treasury. Let us notice this matter of funding the temple as it must have existed in the time of Christ when Herod's temple was in full operation. The temple was responsible for bringing into Jerusalem huge quantities of monies and other contributions from Jews and even Gentiles, because there were a lot of believing Gentiles in the Roman Empire and in the Parthian worlds. Note the words of Titus, the Roman general and later emperor, in a speech to the Jews just before the fall of Jerusalem. He called attention to the riches of the Jews at the time and how the Romans had helped them secure those riches. Titus says, quote, this is in Josephus, Wars of the Jews, chapter 6, book 6, chapter 6, section 2. Quote, we, the Romans, have given you leave to gather up that tribute which is paid to God, meaning the temple tax, with such other gifts that are dedicated to him, nor have we called those that carried these donations to account, nor prohibited them, till at length you became richer than we ourselves, even when you were our enemies. End quote. This tribute was the annual half shekel payment for the upkeep of the temple, which each Jewish male from 20 years of age upward had to pay each year. This money was collected from various sites all over the Roman Empire and conveyed, in many instances, under guard of the Romans themselves to the temple treasury in Jerusalem. This tribute alone, besides all the other offerings of money and animals that was sent to the temple, amounted to a prodigious quantity of revenue each year. Now let's try and understand how much this would be in, when Dr. Martin wrote this, in 1993 dollars. The coin in the fish that Peter brought, caught, you know, that had the coin in its mouth?
Yes.
And this was in Matthew 17, verse 27. The coin had the value of one shekel, called a stater in Greek. This would pay the annual tribute for Jesus and Peter in Matthew 17, verse 27. A stater was equal to 4 drachma, with each drachma being a little more in value than a Roman denarius. A denarius, according to Jesus, was what a common laborer would receive in one day. Thus, a half shekel would be equal about 2 days' work. Since our minimum wage in 1993, Dr. Martin writes, was just under $5 an hour, a 12-hour day would gain a person about $60 at the present time in 93. Thus, 2 such days would be $120. Based on our work pay scenario today, about $120 is what each Jewish male over 20 would have to pay each year to the temple treasury. Of course, today when I'm doing this show in 2007, that would be factored up probably by about one-third more. So you'd be dealing with about $180 in 2007 current dollars. That's what each Jewish male over 20 would be required to pay each year to the temple treasury. And since it's reasonable to estimate that there would have been between 3 and 4 million Jewish males in the Roman Empire who would have paid the tribute each year, this would have amounted to between 360 to 500 million U.S. dollars just for the half shekel tribute alone. And then there were, offerings and contributions to the temple just because God, you know, people loved God. So it was the Sanhedrin at the temple in Jerusalem that set the value of the half shekel each year. The value was determined by the value of the half shekel was determined by the value of the animal sin offerings each year. And this is according to Shelakim 2, verse 4 from the Talmud. If the value of sin offering animals went up because of scarcity, then the Sanhedrin would require more of the common currency to equal the amount of the shekel at the temple. The standard of value was set by the temple authorities so that God would have the same amount being given to the treasury each year, no matter what the value of the coinage, whether it was inflated or deflated. And whatever the case, there were great quantities of money coming into Jerusalem each year. And this helped make the economy of Judea and Jerusalem a very prosperous one. It also provided the money for King Herod to improve the temple. Much of that came from the temple treasury and was supported by the Sanhedrin. That wealth, however, came to an end with the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 CE. With the temple destroyed for 40 years after Christ, the Jews did not have to pay the tithe for its upkeep any longer. They were required by the Romans to continue paying the half shekel, but they had to pay it to the Roman treasury. And this continued from 70 AD until its rescission of this law in 429 CE.
Oh, gee. Wow.
That's what the Romans required.
Yeah.
You don't mess with the Romans.
Yeah, right. IRS on steroids. You betcha.
As a matter of fact, I read a book about Roman military policy.
Mm-hmm.
And the Romans actually were quite shocked that the Jews rebelled. And they thought they had given the Jews, they had treated the Jews well. They respected their religion, and they helped them with the temple treasure and everything, and protected it, because Herod had helped the Romans and kept the, you know, Judea stable for so many years, and so did the other leaders of the Jews. And they were quite, you know, and there's always been upsets and problems wherever Jews have lived in large groups. I mean, Josephus talks about that. They were fighting all the time in the temple amongst themselves. But in general, they kept the peace on the east southeastern border, or the eastern border in the south, south of Syria, for a long, long time.
Yeah.
And the when the Jews rebelled, the other Jews in the empire were watched very carefully. There was even a threat that the Parthians might be encouraged by the Jews in Babylon to help rescue the Jews in Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a threat. This was a major threat to the heart of the empire, because as Cicero even said, that the Jews on the Sabbath, everything stopped in Rome. Nobody did business in Rome, because the Jewish financiers and the businessmen in Rome practically shut down the city on the Sabbath.
Okay, what did they consider the Sabbath? Friday?
Saturday, yeah.
Like Friday at sundown.
Friday sundown to Saturday sundown.
Yeah.
And it's much like you would go to Jerusalem today. Mm-hmm. I mean, nothing is open. Mm-hmm. I understand from Dr. Martin, it used to be different, but nowadays, the times that I've been there in the last couple of years, it shuts down, and the only place you can get something to eat is at the American-run YMCA, mm-hmm. and at a Chinese restaurant. I know a good one in Jerusalem.
Oh, my goodness.
In any case. And, you know, it's not too well attended on Fridays, but it's open for business, and I enjoy it when mm-hmm. I go there. It's about the only two places that you can find. Now, of course, the restaurants are... In the hotels, they have to be open on the Sabbath for their patrons. But
yeah.
On Friday night, it's tough to find something that, you know, although you can go to the Armenian section and there's restaurants in the old city. But the point is, back to the point, the Jews were a very powerful segment of the Roman Empire, about 10% of the population. And they were very wealthy, and they were in very large groups in Antioch and Jerusalem and, of course, Babylon, which was near the eastern border of the empire, Roman Empire, and in Rome and Alexandria. They all had riots and upsets, and Emperor Claudius threw them out, actually, of Rome, all the Jews out of Rome. And this is talked about by Paul when he meets Aquila and Priscilla. Who were instructing Apollos in the book of Acts. And it's all part of that historical background.
Right.
And so the Romans kind of felt betrayed, and their military policy was such that they weren't going to put up with any of this. So they literally went in, destroyed the city of Jerusalem, destroyed the temple, laid the city completely waste, not one stone upon another in either the city or the temple. Not just the temple, but the entire city, so that it didn't even look like a city had ever been there. When Titus returned a couple years after the Jewish War, he came back to Jerusalem and he said, I just can't believe it. The destruction is total, absolute. It's just a mass of stones and that's all. There's nothing left of Jerusalem. And Josephus confirmed this, that Titus had said this. And the whole story of Masada does not occur anywhere else except in Josephus' Wars of the Jews.
Right.
And this book that I've read on Roman military policy, it said that the people that were in Masada were not a threat to, you know, counterattack the Romans. But they attacked Masada. The Romans attacked Masada with a legion, at least, for the sole purpose that it doesn't matter what you do or where you go, we will get you, and we will find you, and we will kill you all.
Yeah.
It was an object lesson to the rest of the empire, as broadcast by Josephus, that we will leave no stone unturned against rebels, even among the favored Jews. And that object lesson was made very, very plain.
It was horrible.
And, And this is the way tyrants do things.
Yeah.
This is what Saddam Hussein did. This is what Hitler and the Chinese did when the communists took power. This is what Lenin and Stalin did. You massacre people and kill them all, if you have to as an object lesson for other population groups who might even be thinking of, rebelling. So, the Romans moved heaven and earth to literally, they built a ramp, which is still there at Masada, and the remains of the Roman camp is still there at Masada. And you can just see the tremendous endeavor. Remember, this is stone by stone and rock by rock.
Yeah.
They did these things to conquer Masada. And then, of course, everyone committed suicide except a few survivors, women who hid themselves. But, Jerusalem and the Jews were very wealthy in the land of Judea because of the temple tithe. Not because of the tithe, but because of the temple tax.
Yeah.
And so a lot of money was brought in to Jerusalem. And once the biblical regulations concerning the law of tithing are understood, then you can see how far modern Christian advocates of the tithing system for the Christian ministry have strayed from the truth.
Oh, boy, you can say that again.
Josephus said, if the Jews had not rebelled against the Romans, there would have been no problems. But there's actually eschatological reasons that the Jews did what they did. Not reasons, but they thought time cycles were coming to a head and that God was going to defend them. You see this in the Dead Sea Scrolls, this apocalyptic way of thinking. You see it in the apocalyptic books, extra-biblical books that were extant at the time. And, they stopped paying tithes and they stopped all obedience to all authority. And actually the Jews lost Jerusalem because they fought amongst themselves. Literally rival street gangs who were defending the cities fought amongst themselves as much as they did against the Romans. And Josephus says this. And Christianity does that, too. They tend to fight amongst themselves.
Oh, yeah.
And, one group advocates tithing, and, another group says, oh, no, you have to tithe my way. But tithing for Christians is not the way to, run a ministry. It should be by offering, free will gifts and offerings. And that's how it should be done today, not by tithes in any church or religious organization that exists.
Well, there's a law, a biblical law, about sowing and reaping.
Yeah.
And it's as good today as it was back then.
Yeah. And this also applies to your thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
What you think
that
about,
right.
That's what you are, and that's what you will be.
Yeah.
And, where your treasure is, where your heart is, your treasure is, that's where your heart will be.
Yeah.
And, the next chapter concerns the teachings of the New Testament, and it supports the Old Testament precisely. So the next chapter is, chapter 10. The New Testament and tithing, and I think we'll, have to wait till next time. But, the whole idea is that tithing was required for the ancient Israelites. For us, we have the privilege of supporting anything we want to. the Israelites had to support the Levites because they were commanded to. And the tithe had to be paid at a certain time, to a certain place, in a certain way, and only on certain things. We're freed from that. We don't have to tithe. We can give free will offerings, you know, to the bite show or whatever, so that we can, or whatever ministry, whatever helps people is what should receive your gifts, not, you know, I hate to speak against any particular organization, but when a large religious denomination settles for $660 million because of sexual abuse by their clergy, as occurred in the Roman Catholic Archdiocese, that's a lot of gifts and offerings, folks, that aren't going to the people who need it.
That's right.
They're going to victims because of malfeasance in office. Mm-hmm. And because of criminal activity, you know, mm-hmm. give it to the good guys.
Yeah.
Give it to people who are doing a good purpose and doing good work.
Well, you know,
it's amazing.
If people get fed here at this table, you know.
Yeah. Well, you've got a smorgasbord.
Yeah. Well,
buffet.
A buffet. That's cute, David. Thank you.
The Bite Show Buffet.
The Bite Show Buffet. There you go.
You're in Vegas. What the heck?
Yeah, we
have, known for their buffet.
We have buffets. Oh, my goodness. Oh, that was cute.
So, yeah, we'll get into the New Testament and the tithing next time. That's chapter 10. Okay?
Okay. Sounds great. Wow. This, you know, there's been quite a few people that have listened to part one and part two, and they were very appreciative of this information. Nobody ever had told them these things.
Yeah.
And, you know, I could understand why the big mainline churches keep this stuff quiet.
Right.
You know, yeah, darn right.
Well, there's something else, too, you know. If you learn the truth, you know, give a little appreciation to those who are giving you the truth.
Yeah.
You know, or making it available to you.
That's right.
You know, over 100, like I've mentioned before, over 100,000 of this copies of this book in various stages of development over 25 years or more have gone out to people, and very few people have responded by saying thank you financially, you know, for all the money that they've been saved because they've, you know, been freed from what they thought was a requirement for tithing.
Yeah.
And never hear from them again.
Yeah.
You know, now whether they just resent all religion because once they learn the truth, or whether it's, you know, blame the messenger, who knows? But
that's right.
That's the way it goes.
Well, and there are people out there that they don't have much, David, but they manage to help out.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
I want
absolutely.
I want to say God bless those that are doing that. If it weren't for you, there would be no Bite Show.
Right.
So God bless you all for that. And you too, David, for coming on here and talking about things that, you know, are so hidden in the world today. I mean,
right.
And have been hidden away from people. And I know this is very important information for the listeners, and I know that they appreciate it. And I would ask the listeners to send David Seeloff an email at David. And then put the at sign, askelm.com, and let him know that you appreciate this information. That's encouraging for him. So, you know, and that's good manners. And we have well-mannered listeners. except a few of my gals down in the Bayou country. They're, boy, they're outspoken girls, and I just love each one of them. Oh, my goodness. But we all want to stand strong in Jesus Christ, and we want to know the truth. We want to be taught the truth. And that's why these archives are, they're a resource for people, because you don't find these things out there just any place.
It costs money to store these large files.
Oh yes,
it on
does.
The internet.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You betcha. And I encourage people out there that if this is valuable to you, make copies for your own private archives. The Bite Show audio files are never to be sold. They're free. They're given freely. So there you go. And David, thank you, and God bless you for what you're doing. I need to get a link up where they can get this book, too.
Okay.
The Tithing Dilemma.
Yeah, it's on the ASK webpage, and then just under books, and both online and for purchase.
Okay.
There's a books tab there, so that'll work for you.
All righty. So go to the website, ask Elm, askelm.com. Remember to let David Seeloff know your appreciation for his time that he spends with us on the Bite Show. Email him and just say thanks. Or if you have a question, you know, go ahead and ask. That's how we learn. So God bless everybody out there for listening. This concludes file, audio file number 3 of The Tithing Dilemma. And I'm learning a lot too, so I'm having fun. God bless everybody out there. Good night.